Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to today's program. I'm Marcus Peter. We are continuing the conversations of consequence and significance that we had at Acton University, and in this hour we'll be speaking about, firstly, navigating the rising tide of political polarization. Now, this is a problem, and I've recently been blessed to have read a book by Ezra Klein about why we're polarized. It's not good for Americans, the average American, for the everyday person to ascribe to partisanship, because at that point we are voting our parties in, even if it means the denigration of that which is objectively good and true for society. Polarization by itself is not inherently bad if it's not overt and extreme. However, the rising tide of political polarization in the United States simply means that either one side possesses a utopian vision. In fact, when we think about the liberal left, the utopian vision of the left has inspired a shift towards various forms of a kind of reactionaryism. And that reactionaryism seems manifest for those on the other side of or their polar opposite, not just in the United States of America, but this has become a global phenomenon. When we talk about faith and freedom, we're not just talking about being centrist. We're talking about the constant pursuit of what does objective truth teach us. Because objective truth calls us to objective moral life. And knowing what morality dictates means that we can choose to live well. And our decisions can then inform not just our voting decisions, but also how we conduct ourselves in society and in work and in free speech. So we talked with Dr. Rachel Ferguson about this. And then in the second and third segments, we talked with Dr. Kevin Vallier and Kyle Washit. Kevin will speak to us about the new Catholic integralism and whether it's true or false, and what are some of the issues that arise from this notion of integralism, which is essentially a reunification of the influence of church over the state, which is an overt statement of the reality of what it was. And then after we talk with Kyle Washit, who is the new president of Wyoming Catholic College, about how we ought to put virtue back in Catholic education. So stay tuned for these intriguing conversations. Right now, the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, July 2nd. It's the Feast of St. Bernardine Riolino. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Louisiana's new law that requires the Ten Commandments to be posted in public schools is inspiring other GOP-led states. Texas State Representative Steve Toth wants to do the same thing.
The Texas Senate passed something similar last session, but it failed in the Texas House.
The plan has the backing of the Texas Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick, saying on social media that the Bible verses remind students of the importance of a fundamental foundation of American and Texas law. Also in Texas, the Supreme Court has upheld a state ban on performing transgender procedures on minors, ordering that the state is within its authority to outlaw extreme medical treatments for young boys and girls. The ban prevents genital reconstruction and other types of surgeries meant to facilitate a gender transition, and also forbids doctors from prescribing puberty blockers. Former President Trump's hush money sentencing is being postponed until September. Trump's lawyers had asked the judge of the case for the delay after the Supreme Court issued a ruling about presidential immunity. Russia's released two Ukrainian Greek Catholic priests who have been imprisoned for nearly 2 years. The pair were captured in November of 2022 and accused of committing subversive and guerrilla activities, including possessing weapons and ammunition. The release was announced by the Aid to the Church in Need, who noted that the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Major Archbishop thanked Pope Francis for his role in the release. And Pope Francis's prayer intention for the month of July is for the pastoral care of the sick. In a video message, the Pope said the anointing of the sick is not a sacrament only for those who are at the point of death. The Pope also urging the faithful to remember that the anointing of the sick is one of healing and restoration that heals the spirit. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Broadcasting from Acton University 2024 here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And my guest for this segment is a new friend, Dr. Rachel Ferguson. She's the director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia University, Chicago, and the assistant dean of the College of Business and professor of business ethics. In fact, she's involved in so many things, it's a wonder that she gets any sleep at all. But Rachel, we've heard raving reviews about your course on Rachel is teaching two courses at Acton University 2024. Mm-hmm. The first is Black Liberation Through the Marketplace, and the second is Like a Tree Planted by Stillwater, Navigating the Rising Tide of Political Polarization. And we've heard raving reviews. So you've been doing excellent. I just want to offer you that first.
Thank you.
Let's get right to the heart of it. One of the biggest problems when it comes to economic issues pertaining to the demographic, black demographic in the United States, is the presupposition that there are models in place that are assisting them, when in reality, some of these models do more to stifle their potential for economic growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such a great point. So we have an entire chapter in the book dedicated to the perverse incentives of the welfare state. Many of these interventions were perhaps well-intentioned.
Right.
Part of LBJ's vision.
Yep.
But in fact, what they do is they create what we call a crowd out effect. Mm-hmm. So when the government comes in and takes the place of a civil society institution, that civil society institution then loses its core purpose and can start to disappear.
Right.
And that's what we saw with government, in a way, taking the place of fathers in the home.
Right.
And so, and now, of course, we have the wonderful Anthony Bradley, who's here for this week as well, who talks about the psychology of fatherhood and just how important it is to have that male presence in the household, just as it's so important to have that female presence, right? In any household and in any neighborhood. And so what we saw over time with the crowd out effect of the welfare state was the breakdown of the family. Mm-hmm. And I want to be clear, this affects white families too, right? Three times as many white people are poor in the United States as black people.
Right.
And there are a lot of welfare dependent white people in rural, impoverished places, mostly, and they're also experiencing the same sorts of family breakdown, which then has that cascade effect onto the children in terms of poverty, low educational outcomes, high levels of addiction, high levels of crime. It's the same picture.
That's right.
In both places, it just looks a little different because one is more scattered form of poverty and one is a more concentrated form of poverty.
Right.
And so we see it differently. And maybe we see it a little less when we see it in white poverty than black poverty because it's scattered.
Right. It's not as concentric.
Exactly. But it's really this a lot of the same things that are occurring. And so looking at those unintended consequences of policies like that, we can see how we need to take a completely different approach when it comes to lifting up destabilized communities.
So going back to some of FDR's early legislations pertaining to his response to the Great Depression, you think about the New Deal, you think about how the New Deal essentially usurped the subsidiarity of states and private institutions to providing welfare and assistance to those in need and put it at the level of the federal government, for good or for ill. You know, that can be debated, right? But the fact of the matter is now that power rests in the federal government. So we're not talking about a welfare state qua state. We're talking about a welfare state qua federal institution. And because of that, it's so pervasive.
Yeah.
So it's created a kind of social contagion at the national level.
Yeah, so the first thing I want to say is there were really interesting black classical liberal and conservative thinkers at the time of the New Deal. Mm-hmm. People like the editor of the Pittsburgh Courier, George Schuyler, people like Zora Neale Hurston, the great novelist and anthropologist, who were saying, this is paternalistic.
That's
this is insulting.
That's
we
right.
don't want this, right? This is going to crowd out our own institutions.
Right.
And remember that black Americans were some of the best at having sort of self-help institutions like the National Negro Business League, like lots of fraternal associations, and Social Security and other things like that did crowd out a lot of that, those really wonderful ways of lifting one another up. And so we saw them saying that at the time, and now we're dealing with those things being enshrined, as you said, in the federal system. So, you know, this is such a difficult thing to contend with because What do you do when the momentum of a system is going so much that it just it's such an uphill battle to right. dismantle it? And so one of the things that I looked at, I have a piece in Perfectus magazine called Innovating Our Way Up. Mm-hmm. And the idea in that piece is, I don't know when we're going to be able to dismantle these terrible policies. Mm-hmm. What can we do to work around them?
Right.
Right. And so I think there are really interesting things we can do to get people transportation to get to work, to get people into housing. Things like I talk about the neighborhood stabilization model of philanthropy, which is a very holistic, long-term, geographically hyper-local kind of approach, where you have to be able to say, look, we have such a deep relationship and I have poured into you for so many years, stay with us in our organization where we're helping you get into work and stay out of the welfare trap.
Uh-huh.
And what I've seen is it's successful. Yep. That you have young people where, you know, that government social worker comes along and tries to reel them into the system. And by then they know enough and they have enough deep love relationships in front of their face in mm-hmm. their community that that person is able to say, don't let them trap you. We have a better plan. We have a job. We have a way to make you self-sustaining, and have that young student say, you know what? I don't want to go down the same road that I've seen so many others before me go down. I'm going to give these people a chance because I've seen them love me year after year after year.
You know, Hurston was almost prophetic in his criticism of the New Deal, because he was completely right. Not only did he call out the fact that it was paternalistic, he also foresaw where this would go, what would happen as a result. And so when we're talking about these focused means of providing welfare and assistance to enable the individual to become self-sustaining members of society, contributing to the common good at their smaller level so that eventually the entire society can benefit, that's what the principle of subsidiarity in application ought to look like.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I want to be clear here. It's very popular among conservatives to talk about the welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to be clear that some of the things that you hear maybe from other groups are actually also contributors. For instance, things like FHA redlining,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
things like the building of the federal highway system, things like urban renewal, which was basically an abuse of, eminent domain, mm-hmm. right, for slum, quote unquote slum clearance. James Baldwin called it Negro removal.
That's right.
Right. And so what do you see? These programs are also destroying civil society yep. institutions. They're also running through well-developed neighborhoods, mm-hmm. right? And they're also scattering people away right. from their fraternal association, their church, right. their reading club, their small businesses, mm-hmm. right? And so one of the things I do in my book, Black Liberation Through the Marketplace, is say to conservatives, your story isn't wrong, but don't oversimplify.
Yep.
There's a lot of things happening here, and you can actually agree with some of the people on the other side in certain ways and say, yeah, you know, the damage of those programs that you're upset about because they were racist, the real damage is the way that it affected social capital.
That's right.
Right? And social capital is how we build wealth and healthy yep. families and healthy churches.
Yep.
And so I think there's an opportunity there to be a little more nuanced and bring in a little more subtlety and help people on the other side, perhaps, of the ideological spectrum to understand what conservatives mean when we talk about community, family,
that's right.
and wealth building.
That's right. So going back to that notion of social capital in light of subsidiarity, right? It's a decentralization for the sake of building these, rebuilding, if you will, these focused frameworks and communities for individuals. Because on the one hand, sure, we are individuals, but we don't thrive as individuals. The common good cannot be served
That's right.
if one individual is just thriving by themselves.
Right. Yeah. A really great example of this in the Black tradition is what's called self-help. You know, we think of the word self-help and you think, are you talking about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps?
Yep.
Right? Oh, no. That's not what the term self-help means mm-hmm. in the Black American tradition. The idea is that our group, right, Black Americans, will help each other because, frankly, people aren't really helping us.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw that with Booker T. Washington and the National Negro right. Business League. He's saying, let's band together. Let's support each other's businesses. Let's advertise together. Let's, those of us who are doing better, offer loans to those of us who are starting out,
mm-hmm.
right? And because of things like the incredible proliferation of fraternal associations and really the amazing Black church attendance, which was just through the roof at the turn of the century, what you had is such wonderful connectedness that people were able to do those things at in a way that honors the principle of subsidiarity.
Right.
And what we saw is that just the sort of progressive mindset of massive central planning and social engineering from above does not work. Yeah. And not only did it fail, but it did damage, terrible damage that we're still yet to recover from in many ways. And so we want to go back and reclaim the wonderful Black American traditions of subsidiarity and say these institutions can be revived and rethought, right, for the modern day, and go back and sort of take pride, right, in something that helped people to gain literacy, to gain civil rights, to build a Black economy, and say, let's not forget about that. Let's reclaim that.
That's right. To also reclaim the notion of thinking well, that we can live well, this conversation of what the good life ought to look like, because the reestablishment of these communities that allow for subsidiarity means that these communities then network, and the networking creates a system of solidarity. So even at the ground roots level, so like going back to exactly what you were saying, this whole centralization of the welfare state and the overreach of a federal government effectively means that the dignity of the individual is cast out in the name of statistics.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, conservatives are sometimes accused of being hyper-individualists. Mm. And I think that it's the opposite. There's a healthy individualism there, right? Especially in terms of legal rights.
Right.
But there's also a healthy understanding of the way that individuals develop morally, which is, of course, in a healthy family, in a healthy neighborhood. You even see, speaking of family formation, you even see the fact that if you are a person without a father, but you grew up in a neighborhood where there are lots of fathers,
that's right,
you will do so much better than someone who's in a neighborhood where other kids don't have a father either, right? So there's these network effects, and conservatives actually understand this really well. And what's strange is that when you look at the other side, maybe the far left, they think of themselves as communitarians, but often what their actual government programs do is atomize people, right? They destroy the interdependence between people and make them only dependent on the state.
Right.
So now it's just the individual and the state with no intervening institutions.
Yep.
And that's what they're not sensitive to. So they'll often use language that sounds more communitarian, but it doesn't actually give you communitarian results.
So Rachel, we are running out of time in this segment. Just a very quick exhortation for a pathway forward.
Oh my goodness. So we talk about several solutions in the book. We talk about economic freedom, educational freedom, smart criminal justice reform, not stupid criminal justice reform. But the big one is neighborhood stabilization. Yeah. It's really looking at the way we're doing philanthropy and saying, am I helping people survive till Tuesday, but actually making them dependent on me? Or do I have a bigger transformative vision for their lives that's helping them to become not dependent on me, but rather dignified and dependent on themselves? And so,
thank you.
We need to reflect on that.
Thank you so much. My guest, Rachel Ferguson, director of the Free Enterprise Center at Concordia University, Chicago, and she's teaching a course on Black liberation through the marketplace. I'm Marcus Peter.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
People think it's easier to stay in the muck. The devil that we know is easier than the devil we don't know, but what they don't realize is that the situation can get worse. And what we're seeing now with some of these very liberal orders, let's say, for example, these liberal orders that are dying out, especially religious sisters, dying out, literally folding. And then you have the religious orders such as the Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Dominican Sisters in Nashville, the Sisters of Life in New York, flooded with requests for information and to meet with the sisters about this beautiful life, because they're so joyful because they are living the truth of Scripture and the truth of the Eucharist, of Jesus. But these people will not let go, because then you have to look yourself in the mirror and then you have to surrender. I think it all goes back to the Garden of Eden. Who's God? Are we God or is God God?
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Nothing illustrates the powerful bond between man and wife intended by God, the creator of marriage, than these words from Matthew's Gospel. A true marriage is a sacramental bond and is therefore indissoluble. The Catholic Catechism, however, realistically acknowledges that the presence of evil can severely strain this bond. Marital union has always been threatened by discord, a spirit of domination, jealousy, infidelity, and conflicts that can escalate into hatred and separation. The original communion of Adam and Eve was ruptured by their sin of disobedience. Their relations were distorted by mutual recrimination, says the Catechism, and brought about the pain of childbirth and the toil of work. Without God's help, a man and woman cannot achieve the union of their lives for which God created them in the beginning. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Every year, couples who go on the Ave Maria Radio's Good News Cruise testify how their marriages are revitalized and transformed. Join us on the next Good News Cruise from January 5th to 11th on the Royal Caribbean's Oasis of the Seas. You'll be joined by Father Michael Schmitz, Teresa Tomeo, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and many more speakers. Cabins are selling fast, so be sure to book your spot now. Faith and fun on the sea and in the sun. There's no topping that. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the travel tab to find out more.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, broadcasting from Acton University 2024 in Grand Rapids. And we are joined by a friend of Al's, a friend of this program. And he's joining us this year to talk about two more courses that he's teaching here at Acton University. Dr. Kevin Vallier, professor of philosophy at Bowling Green State University, where he directs their program in philosophy, politics, economics, and law. He is teaching the courses on classical liberalism in a polarized age and the new Catholic integralism, true or false. Kevin, it's wonderful to have you on.
It's great to be here.
So I'd like to open the conversation with the notion of classical liberalism, but in order to do that, as you well know here in Acton, the definition of the word liberal with regard to classical liberalism versus modern liberalism, it can be diametrically opposed, let alone starkly different. So let's define those terms.
Sure. So the way I see the liberal tradition broadly is involving three or four rather political principles. That is, these aren't principles that constitute the individual's good life or the life well lived. They're not also just institutional principles, like have the rule of law. There's something in between. They're principles that specify what government can and can't or supposed to do and not supposed to do. So knowing that, I think liberalism provides political principles that tell us what governments should and shouldn't do.
Right.
So then here are the four basic principles of liberalism very broadly. There's a commitment to human freedom. There's a commitment to the equal worth of persons. There's a commitment to toleration of differences.
Yep.
And then there's a principle that I call the harmony of interests, the idea that society can be organized so that everyone can be better off. Other traditions, say, for instance, in conservatism or really more in socialism, have a kind of more of a zero-sum mindset. Now, classical liberalism understands liberty, the first principle, a little bit more in terms of non-interference. They see equality as about equal rights, equality before the law. With toleration, it tends to be very, very broad in terms of the range of people tolerated, up to the point where kind of inegalitarian, very conservative groups are tolerated. And then on the harmony of interests, it's really interests that get reconciled by the market economy. And all of these claims limit government. The government can't interfere with our negative liberties. They can't treat us unequally. They can't be intolerant. And they can't create, shouldn't create economic structures where we're tearing each other apart.
That's right.
Right. Progressive liberalism, on the other hand, has more of a kind of conception of positive liberty, where freedom is like freedom from want. And so others can be kind of, you know, pushed to provide services to others. Egalitarian commitments mean things like lots of redistribution. So equal treatment means something like equal shares.
That's right.
Toleration is more of a secular commitment of kind of removing religion from the public square. And the harmony of interests is not achieved in the market, which they see as conflictual, but in the democratic process.
That's right.
So that's my account of what liberal tradition is, and then what distinguishes classical liberals from progressive liberals.
So in essence, therefore, the fact of the matter is, constitutionally and according to our Bill of Rights, America in its founding possesses classical liberal traits. And not just traits, the spirit of classical liberalism is an undergirding principle in the founding of the United States.
It's complicated because the founders were not sort of thinking primarily about negative liberty. They were thinking about stopping arbitrary interference. So libertarians will say, look, I mean, if you interfere in a planned way versus an unplanned or threatening way or arbitrary way, that's all bad. But you can see in Hayek, but also in the founders, that a lot of the concern was with arbitrary interference, which they thought was especially tyrannical. It's also the case that while they were religiously tolerant, they didn't mind intolerance at the level of the states. Because they were, you know, most of them had established churches. You know, they did like them to be mild in certain respects. So I guess I would say that I think they're in the ambit of classical liberals, but there are a few differences that I would stress. I think you don't get really clear classical liberalism to the early 19th century with a figure like, say, Benjamin Constant and, say, John Stuart Mill. And so,
That's right.
Yeah.
So thinking in terms of John Stuart Mill and the application of classical liberalism in the way we think today, now we're seeing a greater and greater rise of progressive liberalism that in its battle cry for tolerance becomes more and more intolerant to any opposing view.
Yes, especially to religious conservatives.
Right. So in the light of that, there's a response that classical liberalism can provide.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of it has to do with learning to apply religious toleration to ideology. It's also the case of political action that's meant to resist kind of left-wing revolution. And it can be sort of counter-revolutionary in terms of getting, wanting to sort of roll everything back, restoration of the previous moral order. Others are kind of, you know, more Burkean in the sense of being reformist, right? Trying to make, you know, various reforms in order to sort of slow things down or change things without a kind of utter social transformation.
I'd like to pivot the conversation then, but also in light of that, when you talk about the kind of integralism, when it comes to especially the church in general, but the Catholic Church, the new Catholic integralism that you're talking about. First of all, let's define our terms here. You've got integralism, you've got a kind of soft integralism that you argue for. And how that applies to the living out of the American society.
So here's how I understand Catholic integralism. It consists of three principles. First, the principle that God has authorized the state to promote the temporal common good of the people. The second principle is that God has authorized the church to preach the gospel, but also to promote the supernatural or eternal good of its members.
Right.
Now, basically, all Christians can accept those two claims. It's the third claim that changes it. The church, being having the nobler end of salvation, has a kind of indirect power over the state to authorize the state to support its mission with civil penalties. So you excommunicate a heretic through the canon law courts. They don't respond. The heretic doesn't approve. So then maybe you can fine or imprison them or worse.
Right, right.
So integralism is saying there's an integration of the church and the state with the church as the superior entity They can't take over the state's divine mission. They can't say, look, you know, people have to go to Mass, so we're going to provide agricultural policy. But on spiritual matters, they can sort of direct the state to help support its mission. So integralist regimes could be democratic or monarchical, large or small, capitalist or socialist, but they have to meet those three conditions. The key condition being this idea of the indirect power of the Pope and his bishops over Christian states.
And then there's a distinction then to be made between an integralist society versus, say, religious oligarchy.
Yes.
Or a theocracy.
Yes. So, you know, a three-ecratic order would be that the state's power and authority flows through and from the church. Mm-hmm. Whereas on integralism, there are directly authorized divine missions for the two powers.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so in light of that, then, there's a kind of nuanced argument to be made for soft integralism when it comes to this application of church and state.
So soft integralism is a term invented by Catholic philosopher Ed Fazer. Mm-hmm. And Fazer's understanding of soft integralism is that integralism is the ideal regime, but it's so unrealistic or unlikely we can kind of shelve it. The book I'm dealing with people who have more moderate or hard integralist views about going to it now or how we would get to it in general, how much we would use these canon law penalties and things to produce religious uniformity of the kind that we like. But I do have a article in the public discourse arguing against soft integralism, where I think that effectively you're saying integralism is good in theory but bad in most practice. And I think that because integralism is a theory of the how to handle politically the fall,
right,
you've got sin in the ideal, and so that's going to tarnish it as an ideal. At least the liberal and socialist ideals say, look, if you get the institutions right, you'll get the people right. And so it makes sense to do kind of radical ideal theorizing in a way that I don't think makes sense for integralism. So I don't think integralism can be good in theory but bad in practice. And so I think soft integralism has a kind of problem of internal coherence in that respect. So, but then you get to the more moderate or hard forms of integralism, and then my arguments apply in the book, apply to them full force.
Right. So then moving back then to the conversation of classical liberalism, in the public sphere, is it compatible with a society that has established an integralistic approach?
Sorry, say it again.
With regard to classical liberalism in general, is the practice of classical liberalism possible, doable, livable in a society that has an integralist approach?
I mean, they're pretty much incompatible. Because the integralist state is not a tolerant state except for merely prudential reasons.
Right.
Now, it does have to tolerate religions that are where people are unbaptized. But for the baptized members of society, their religious liberties can be restricted. So, for instance, validly baptized Protestants could face certain legal restrictions in various regards. And maybe even their voting rights limited. So that would be one incompatibility. The baptized liberty would be restricted. And, you know, so these are ways of departing from liberalism. Sharply.
Okay. Sharply, right. So, let's zoom into this final part. We've got just under a minute here. Given the polarization of the age, especially partisan polarization, how do we see the language of classical liberalism moving forward, especially the spirit of the fathers?
Yeah, I think it's really important that classical liberals commit themselves to a kind of peacemaking agenda between left and right. And the reason is that the greatest threat to freedom in the United States today is ourselves. And polarization leading us, and lower trust leading us to try to control each other more and more.
Right.
And so it's important for classical liberals to point out the way in which lower trust and high political polarization is destroying freedom. Moreover, how to avoid polarization and lower trust ourselves. Because right now, I think the libertarian or classical liberal movement is divided, is having its own culture wars.
So. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin, for making the time to talk to us. How about a final exhortation in terms of living out a liberal life in the sphere that we have today?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have to be Christians, I think, of course. What that means is kind of following through Jesus' hope that we would be unified, the desire for peace, the avoiding of violence, and thinking about how that applies to improving and healing American political divisions.
Thank you so much, Kevin. My guest has been Dr. Kevin Vallier, Professor of Philosophy at Bowling Green State University, where he directs their program in Philosophy, Politics, Economics, and Law. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Vita, broadcasting at Acton University 2024.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John, chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets. All the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
Father Benedict Rochelle.
I must tell you that from what I observe from very young people, all of these blasphemers, all of these mockers are in for a tough time. Because the devil bites his own tail. And I find among young people a growing reverence and longing for God. I find a decline in the cynicism and skepticism around, because it had to destroy itself. No one can live on being an enemy of God. It's too crazy. It's too absurd. It's too dark. It's too bleak. God is beautiful. God is holy. Why in the world mock God?
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. As I've mentioned, we're broadcasting from Acton University 2024, and one of the great joys of this conference is the ability to make new connections, to rekindle old friendships, and to foster new ones. And joining us for this segment is a new friend, Kyle Washit, who is the new president of Wyoming Catholic College. He is a Wyoming native who has been with Wyoming Catholic College since its inception in varying capacities. He holds numerous degrees, but
the most recent ones being a master's and a licentiate from in sacred theology from the International Theological Institute in Austria. Kyle, it's great to have you on the program. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having me, Marcus.
Oh, the joy is all ours. So I'd like to talk about Catholic education. Oh, actually, you know what? Formation of the whole person in general, not just Catholic education. This notion of liberal arts education, which is one of the big topics of Acton University. It's impossible to have a conversation on educating the person if you don't first have a foundational framework for how you view the human person.
That's absolutely right, right? That there are any number of slogans out there from secular universities and various religious universities all claiming that they're educating the whole person, but what they think the person is,
right.
Is the person simply an agent who is going to be a political activist? Is the person simply a machine? Is the person simply a materialist conception? Or is it their soul-body split? Any of those things are going to radically affect the way you think about who it is that you're educating.
Right. And so then you got to take that one step further. You can't have a conversation on what the human person is and how to view the human person if you don't have a concept of what good and true are.
Exactly, right? Both the person, you have to sort of say there's some measure of what I say the person is, that the person's not measured simply by their will, but there is a external measure, namely, as you said, the goodness and the truth that we're responding to, and that's what we're going to root our conversation of the person at.
Yep. Your address to your students at Wyoming Catholic College at the end of the year was very spot on in terms of a critique of what education has become. Now, you mentioned Emperor Has No Clothes moment. The truth is, it's more than just a moment. This whole Emperor Has No Clothes ideology has become a culture.
That's it. Right, that we're all willing to keep saying things are going fine.
That's right.
And in fact, the article just in the Free Press about we're living in a late Soviet America, whether an inflammatory line or not, the claim being there's a fundamental ideology that we all give lip service to, even though none of us believe it.
Yep. And all of the markers, I read that same article in the Free Press, and all of the markers that denote what one would call a Soviet regime are already existent in the public sphere, albeit in a latent capacity, in a very subtle level here in America.
Yeah, not in the extreme way that maybe we saw them in the late 80s or early 90s, but certainly in that, as you said, a latent way, a way in which there's an ideology that governs us that we don't believe in. Mm-hmm. We're disengaged from political processes.
Yep.
We leave that to an exceptionally old guard that rules.
Yep.
And more fundamentally, we distrust the institutions, especially institutions of higher learning.
Right. There's an inherent distrust of institutions. And one can argue a lot of reasons why, but one of the main reasons is overt government overreach, centralization. Now, big government, essentially. We've come to speak to the average American. I dare say, now this is extrapolating, I don't have a survey to prove this, but I dare say maybe 9 out of 10 Americans don't fully trust their elected representatives, and that does not bode well for a republic democracy.
Exactly. And then if you add to that, you say, well, those public representatives are deeply entwined with the institutional banking system. They're deeply entwined with the legacy institutions of higher ed, whether that's the Ivy Leagues or more prestigious universities, that there's this sort of feedback loop that leads to a general distrust for some of these institutions that are charged with carrying on, again, going back to our vision of the human person, what we're supposed to be doing, what the good consists in, and how we should live our lives.
One of the most heartbreaking things I saw in the 6.5 years that I taught in Catholic education is that there is no way around it. The vast majority of even well-meaning Catholics who are sending their children to well-meaning institutions for the sake of their schooling formation are engaging in a utilitarian STEM. Now, STEM by itself is not evil, but a utilitarian teleological, the teleology of the program is utilitarian, which means this is being done so that you can fulfill an economic purpose, and you fulfill that economic purpose so that you can fill your bank account, but that's hardly the end of the human person.
Right. There's this great Calvin and Hobbes cartoon where poor Calvin is sitting there on the street corner waiting for the school bus to come pick him up, and he's venting to Hobbes. And he says, so I'm here waiting to go to school, and I have to do well so I can get into a good high school. And I have to get into a good high school and do well there so I can get into a good college. And I have to do well at college so I can get a good job, so I can earn money, so I can put my kids in a good school.
And it sounds like such a futilistic loop.
It's true. It's true. There's nothing transcendent. There's nothing that calls the human person to a greater vision of goodness or truth or something that would satisfy the human spirit.
Right. The futility of it all and the almost fatality of it all is that ultimately all it results in is, first of all, the degeneration of the human person and ultimately the destruction of the human person.
Yes, exactly. Well, there's a poem that all of our students memorize, among the 30 poems they memorize, and it's Wordsworth's poem about the world is too much with us. Right? Mm-hmm. He says, the world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our hours. Little we see in nature that is ours, we've given our hearts away, a sordid boon. Boom. He's talking about this sense of alienation, the sense of, when I look out at this wonderful world of beauty and grandeur, the wind and the sea and the moon, I sort of am conditioned by society to look at it the way that Uncle Andrew in C.S. Lewis's The Magician Nephew
looks at
the creation of Narnia, right? How do I industrialize this? How do
That's
I commodify
right.
this?
That's right.
And then what we're saying is that kind of reductionism leads ultimately to a kind of despair, because you realize you're supposed to be moved. And so Wordsworth ends up wishing he were a pagan, because then he would have this sense of life and wonder to the world, even though it would be violent and ugly
That's
in
right.
some ways.
That's
it
right.
would be something more than this nihilistic loop that we're stuck in.
Yes, and the problem with generating entire generations of Uncle Andrews is that the book itself states that he's a vicious man, he's a vile man. This is a man for whom, when you look interiorly into him, he's actually a coward. There's very little good in him. But boy, is he industrious.
Exactly. He's made money. He's got a decent flat in London, right? All mm-hmm. of these things. And that seemingly should be the measure of the person. I always point this out. You know, think about when you were in kindergarten and your kindergarten teacher asks you, so what do you want to be with when you grow up? If you answered, if you were some preternaturally gifted kindergartner, and you answered, well, I'd like to be a deeply virtuous person
That's
with
right.
a great sense of human good that contributes in a fundamental way to my local community, the teacher would be like, no, that's not the question I'm asking. I'm asking
right.
how you want to sell your labor. Like, what do you
right.
want to do for a job? But from that very beginning, we're told that's somehow the measure or mark of success,
mm-hmm.
and that we'll sort of pick up the right worldview or habits of virtue on the side, but what we really need to train for is how we're going to earn our money and be a good
That's
investor.
Right, that's right. That the value of the human person is monetary contribution to a predetermined market.
Exactly.
And we ingrained that in our five-year-olds.
Right, right. And then so being here at the Acton Institute, which is in one sense dedicated to thinking about what the free market is, it's also saying that vision of the free market, that vision of freedom, requires a vision of the human person.
Yep.
So that when we're telling our young people and our students, hey, we need to be committed to pursuing life in a free market, having a kind of entrepreneurial vision for how one acts, we're doing that grounded in this vision of the real value and worth of the human person.
Yes. Now, to take that one step further then, the reason why we want to engage in the work of forming the human person rightly, viewing and forming the human person rightly, is because well-formed individuals who are virtuous live good lives and therefore generate good value in a good market that results in, wait for it, the common good.
Exactly. Exactly. Even this comes up even when I'm on the road talking to people about the education we're offering in Wyoming, is, you know, very interested and supportive. People want to know, well, what are your students going to do with this education?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really important and good question, but we want to nuance it in the way that you were just doing it. We're not bringing students to Wyoming Catholic College as a kind of evangelical boot camp.
Yes.
We want to train them in virtue. We want to train them in a worldview. We want to reinvigorate them in the natural world, because that's a good in itself. But when we do that, there's this sort of abundance that fills them up. And St. Augustine says there's certain goods, specifically common goods, that if you can have them and when you share them, you don't have less of them.
Yes.
You don't really have them until you share them. And this is true about the truth. This is true about moral goodness. It's not true about cookies or bubblegum,
yes,
or money.
Which is the distinction between private and common goods.
Exactly. And so what we are doing when students come to a place like Wyoming Catholic College or liberal arts education in general is we're filling them with common goods, goods that of their nature are going to overflow and be shared and redound to the good of society.
Right. So in a final exhortation, we've got about a minute and a half in the segment. Kyle, parents are listening to this right now. And unfortunately, society inundates them with a vision of education and work for their children. But we ought to re-pivot that to the Catholic vision.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to realize, I'd say, sort of three things. Education is to make our students happy. Not in a sort of flippant emotional way, but a deeply satisfying way.
Right.
And that education begins by rooting them in what is real, in the natural world of truth, good, and beauty, teaching them to reflect on it, teaching them to have the right moral values to respond to that, and then the very nature of that proper understanding is going to redound to them being able to share that as persons, body, soul, spirit, who possess those goods, live in society and share it. That's the vision of education we need to have, and as parents are looking to put their children in educational institutions, they need to not settle for anything less than an institution that offers that vision of education.
Oh, amen, amen. I'm so glad we were able to get this interview with you, Kyle.
Pleasure to meet with you, Marcus. It's been a delight.
Thank you. My guest has been Kyle Washit, the new president at Wyoming Catholic College, a Wyoming native. He holds a master's degree and licentiate degree in sacred theology from the International Theological Institute, and we've been talking about the reality of sound, virtuous education. We're at Acton University 2024. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization. Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Good afternoon, welcome back. The reality of sin, in contrast with the central identity of human dignity, means that we ought to employ our best safeguards against corruption that would inhibit the recognition of the dignity of every individual in society. And that's why small government, a government that recognizes the kind of superiority of a principle of subsidiarity, which means letting the lowest local level of government and institutions cater to the needs of the individual, is what inevitably leads to a free society that ensures the space for the individual to cultivate virtue. At the same time, we want to measure the ideals of morality and truth with the experience as it is being lived, because as we keep doing so, we can keep tweaking our decision-making, our policies. Because the common good isn't just about what benefits the most amount of people. The common good is about every single individual flourishing within a society. And that's the ideal of the teaching. That is the call of Catholic social teaching. And if we do so, this will enrich and develop not just our understanding, but our flourishing within the culture. And we will begin to realize the importance of the ideals behind the American founding. And rather than tout it in reductionistic slogans about liberalism, we can finally start talking about the spirit of the fathers in terms of the objectivity of truth that governs us into a virtuous state and society. Because to promote virtue is to promote order. True virtue is impossible without liberty, and liberty necessitates virtuous order. So this is cyclic in reality. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at avemariaradio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at avemariaradio.net.